From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've all been there, pencil in hand, standard issue form laid out, asking you to check a box. Caucasian, African-American, Hispanic, Asian, or the great catch-all, other. A lot can ride on that one swipe of the pencil. What if your admission to college wrote on which box you checked? For thousands of young people across America, for almost a quarter century, at least in some degree, it has. Affirmative action was hugely controversial from day one, but nationwide, colleges and universities have worked to diversify their classrooms with special consideration of race when evaluating candidates for admission. Supporters say affirmative action helps schools engineer a vibrant, racially diverse student body where all students benefit. They say without it, classrooms would fade to a whiter shade of pale. Opponents have said from the beginning that affirmative action unfairly keeps out better students in favor of less qualified candidates. Now they say affirmative action is simply out of date, past its prime. Dahlia Lithwick, senior, we have a debrief to start this hour from Dahlia Lithwick, the senior editor and Supreme Court correspondent for Slate.com. I asked her, what's up with the Supreme Court consideration of affirmative action?
Those are the questions that everyone's asking. They've had opportunities to take affirmative action cases in education for years now. 6 years ago, they turned down the Texas case, the Hopwood case that everyone thought they would take, and they've turned down several cases out of Georgia, out of the University of Washington. No one knows why they turned down all those cases and took these ones. One view of it is this case is a very, very good, clear case. The people who are plaintiffs in these cases clearly would have gotten into this university but for the affirmative action program.
Can you lay out the cases for us? It's two cases that arise out of the University of Michigan. What are the circumstances?
It was very ironic. One was a challenge to the undergrad admission system. One was a challenge to the law school admission system. And the admission systems between the undergrad and law school are actually quite different, so that throws another wrinkle into it. The admission system in the undergrad case was they actually had fixed points in a point system that they awarded to minority applicants. The law school is much more ambiguous. They were heading for something that was called, quote, a critical mass of minority students. There was never a fixed numeric number, so it's a little bit more ambiguous.
And how did the lower courts rule in these cases?
The undergrad system was actually upheld by the lower courts. The law school system was struck down in the district court. But then the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeal, which is the federal appellate court that includes Michigan, turned around last year and said, no, the law school system is permissible under the Constitution. What was odd about this case is that the Sixth Circuit never ruled on the undergrad case. They kept sort of putting it off and putting it off. And the Supreme Court, when they granted certiorari yesterday, agreeing to hear the cases, they went ahead and swept in the undergrad case into this case that they're going to hear this spring, even though there has yet to be a Sixth Circuit ruling on it.
So we expect oral arguments in March, a decision perhaps in the summertime, maybe June. What do the Supreme Court politics look like on this case?
Everyone is saying, and I think they're probably right, this one is going to come down, as so many do, to Sandra Day O'Connor. It's fairly clear that there are three justices who are opposed to racial preferences under any circumstances. Scalia, Thomas, and Rehnquist think that affirmative action for any reason is impermissible under both the Constitution and under Title VI. The other four justices that are fairly clear are the four quote-unquote liberal justices, Ginsburg, Souter, Breyer, and Stevens, who tend to be in favor of racial preferences when it's remedying what they see as massive social wrong. Mm-hmm. The two sort of question marks are Justices Kennedy and O'Connor, but Kennedy's been fairly opposed to affirmative action over the years. O'Connor has been sort of all over the map. She has been very tough to read. She obviously wasn't on the court 24 years ago in the Bakke case. So we don't quite know where she will come down on affirmative action in education. We do know that in cases of hiring, racial preferences for redistricting, she's gone back and forth, and it's very hard to determine which way she's going to fall.
Is it possible, though, that later next year at some time we might be looking at a changed landscape where affirmative action was no longer an acceptable policy for college admissions?
I think it's more than possible. I think it's likely. And I think it's important to understand that after Bakke was decided 24 years ago, virtually every college adopted what we thought at the time the majority of the court had upheld, and that was a system that said that some affirmative action is permissible, not a fixed quota system, but some preference is permissible based on race in order to achieve quote-unquote diversity. That was the holding of Bakke, we thought.
Which means most colleges made special arrangements to ensure minority representation.
Something like minority representation to the end of, to the legal and political end of, a diverse student body.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question that most public universities that will be affected by this case have tried to accommodate Bakke. Now, the two exceptions, I should say, are in the circuits where already lower courts of appeals have gone the other way. One of the strange things about affirmative action in education is that whole courts of appeals have taken it upon themselves to sort of summarily overrule Bakke. And so we've had the Fifth Circuit, which decided the Hopwood case, and the Eleventh Circuit, which decided the University of Georgia case, basically taking it upon themselves to say, you know, that's never what the Supreme Court meant in Bakke, and completely gutting affirmative action programs. So that one of the reasons I think the court felt compelled to take the Michigan case is that now a program that is completely unconstitutional in Texas is completely permissible in Michigan. And that kind of situation couldn't have been allowed to go on much longer.
So we've got a very checkered situation out there. Is it possible that given how closely split the court is on this, we could end up again with an ambiguous outcome that would leave the country with another generation of checkered policies, pro and con across the country?
I don't think that the policies can be checkered across the country because what the Supreme Court says will go. But I think that you're quite right to say that particularly with Justice O'Connor being the pivotal vote in this case, there's a very good chance that you're going to get the kind of fractured plurality opinion that we got in Bakke. And O'Connor is sort of notorious for being that kind of justice. She loves to write her own opinion. She loves to not sign off on majority opinions and kind of march to the tune of her own constitutional bongo. We could come up with another extremely unreadable opinion where it's not at all clear what the ultimate holding of the case is.
But I guess equally possible at this point that sometime later next year, affirmative action in college admissions might be history, might be a thing of the past.
Well, it's not only possible, as I say, it's likely. And in states like California, for instance, where they've already done away with affirmative action in public education, there has been a massive impact. However you feel about affirmative action, you see the numbers go from the double digits to the single digits of minority students in university programs. And in fact, one of the claims that the University of Michigan is making in this case is that but for their affirmative action program, there would have been 4% minority students in the law school last year. Because of their affirmative action program, there were 14.5% minorities. Now, whether that appeals to one or not, that is a massive and tangible impact that will be seen very quickly.
The stakes are high. Dahlia Lithwick, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor and Supreme Court correspondent for Slate.com. She spoke with us earlier from Washington. So it's all on the table again, maybe on the chopping block. Do America's universities still need affirmative action? Has the era of affirmative action come and gone? Are you ready to see everyone, every race, subjected to the same standard for admissions? Or is that still a recipe for segregation and opportunity denied? Have we moved on or not? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Nashville, Tennessee, is Carol Swain. She's professor of law and political science at Vanderbilt University School of Law. Good evening and welcome, Professor Swain.
Hello.
Hi, thanks.
Good evening.
Hi, thanks for being with us. And in the studio tonight is Angelo Anchetta. He is the legal director of Harvard University's Civil Rights Project. Good evening and welcome, Angelo Anchetta.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
Angelo Anchetta, jump in here with us. What is on the line here? It sounds from our debrief with Dahlia Lithwick as though everything we've known in terms of affirmative action in college admissions for the past almost 25 years could be history this time next year.
Well, it's certainly a possibility. We're looking at the Supreme Court's revisiting of the Bakke decision in 1978. And as Delia discussed earlier, clearly the lower courts have been divided all over the place in this area. And it's really up to the Supreme Court to lay down some rules and say, well, either Bakke is or is not still precedent. And even if it's not, that diversity-based admissions are, in fact, constitutional or they're not constitutional. So it's very much a critical question that we're dealing with.
Bring us up to date here, because in some ways affirmative action sounds like something out of the 80s, the 90s. It's been a little bit quiet, I think, to many people for the last few years. How important has it been in bringing racial diversity to American campuses? How important does it remain today?
Well, no question, it's been absolutely essential. Now, we're dealing, of course, with literally 25 years of policies being in place because the universities and colleges throughout the country that have adopted race-conscious affirmative action have relied on the Bakke decision, mm-hmm. and it's pretty much the status quo, except in those states where it's been outlawed by various court decisions.
And that's a half a dozen or seven states at this
right,
point.
Right, and by initiatives, say, in California or Washington State. Mm-hmm. So clearly, it's a major policy, which has a tremendous impact on the composition of our student bodies and the graduates who go on to be our nation's leaders. So there's no question it's had an incredible and extraordinary impact.
Do you have any numbers off the top of your head on minority representation at universities and how they compare today to 1978?
Well, no. Specific numbers, but certainly if one examines major universities, the elite universities, and look at the compositions where very often you had token numbers prior to affirmative action mm-hmm. programs, and you look at the way things are now where very much close to parity regarding population. So, for example, if you see 5, 10, 15% minority populations where you previously saw maybe less than 1%, that's a tremendous...
But you're saying now it more or less reflects the presence of any given minority in the population at large?
Well, I think we're getting closer to that. There's no question that we're still far from that kind of representation. And we're dealing with some significant inequalities that go further back than college. It goes back to the K-12 system, and those inequalities are exacerbated as we move further through the system. And affirmative action is in part designed to address some of that underrepresentation.
Carol Swain, how do you sum up the impact of affirmative action? Has it been a positive thing, opening opportunity to more racial minorities in America? Is it still important? Is it still a positive thing today?
One of the things I would like to do is make a distinction between affirmative action mm-hmm. as equal opportunity, non-discrimination, and outreach, and affirmative action as racial preferences. Mm-hmm. And I think that affirmative action has certainly opened doors and that we have a significant minority middle class now because of it. But I also believe that we are in a new day today. And that you cannot take policies that were put in place 30 years ago and expect them to work well today. I think affirmative action never reached down far enough to help disadvantaged Americans, regardless of their race, and especially disadvantaged African Americans. And so I believe that the time has come to put it on the table. I believe that what is offensive to most Americans that have problems with the way it operates now in higher education is that it doesn't make a distinction between the children of minority professionals and those that are disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. And I think that what people find, it's something unsettling about a policy that would take the child of, say, some black celebrity or, mm-hmm. or Johnny Cochran and give that child a preference over some poor white or some poor Asian, that's working hard and their children scored higher on tests.
So and still, the Americans race factor alone might decide it. Carol Swain, stand by for a moment. Jack Beattie, I want to bring you in here. Carol Swain is saying society has moved, maybe not entirely moved on, but it's certainly moved, and affirmative action needs to be changed to recognize that.
Well, I think the point she makes about reaching further down in the class system for disadvantaged people of all races is a very good one. And that's why many people think that shifting from a race-based to a class-based sort of affirmative action is the way to go. However, just as a point in history, it does seem to me to be, ironic that since Jamestown to affirmative action, basically, being black, the skin color counted against you. This is the one time, the one area in American mm-hmm. life that it's actually been a plus, and now people want to say, no, sorry, it's unfair.
We're talking tonight about affirmative action. It is back on the table before the U.S. Supreme Court. Do we still need affirmative action? Has it delivered on its promise? Has affirmative action made America a land of opportunity for all? Has it taken us toward or away from our highest ideals? You can join the show tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
Tom Ashbrook, we're talking tonight about affirmative action. It's back on the table. It's going before the U.S. Supreme Court in a couple of cases. There will be oral arguments in March. There will be most likely a decision from the court in June on whether and how affirmative action goes forward. My guests tonight are Angela Anchetto. He's legal director of the Civil Rights Project at Harvard. He's author of Race, Rights, and the Asian American Experience. And Carol Swain, joining us from Nashville. She's professor of political science and law at Vanderbilt University and author of The New White National in America, its threat to integration. You can join us as well. Has affirmative action helped minorities or buried them in stereotypes? If we pull the plug on affirmative action, will American campuses turn Caucasian and Asian or something else? And does affirmative action undercut Black and Latino achievement? Does it leave a stigma or do we need it? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Angela Anchetta, I want to be sure that we all understand exactly how affirmative action is used in college admissions today. What kind of racial preferences, looking at it from that respect, and Carol Swain is drawing distinctions here which are significant, but if we look at racial preferences, what are they? How are they used? What kind of, advantages are given to certain racial minorities in order to ensure their admission or bolster it?
Well, we have to remember that the Bakke case did outlaw certain kinds of programs, and clearly quotas and set-asides are illegal under law. There's no question about that. So what we're seeing being applied in both of the Michigan cases are different kinds of what are called plus systems, mm-hmm. where you look at counting race as a plus factor among several other factors. The law school's program is not quite as explicit as the undergrad program, which employs a point system. So in the Michigan undergrad system, basically 20 points are allocated to underrepresented minorities out of a total of 150 available points. Now, it's important to note that that other students, non-minority students, are certainly eligible for those kinds of points. They can't get the 20 just for being members of minority groups, but they can get any number of points for geographic diversity, background.
So the number of different kind of points, but on the racial line, it means you might have a lower score on this or that, but that might be offset in some degree by a racial consideration.
Right.
In the interest of building a diverse community at the university.
Exactly.
And when you hear Carol Swain's critique of this, saying it creates this kind of odd situation where Johnny Cochran's children or the children of affluent Black professionals or of other minorities are being advantaged in spite of having all the kind of advantages in their social status, if the Supreme Court pushes back against affirmative action generally, does it have an instrument with which it can address outside of expectation development?
Right. Well, it's important, and I would certainly agree with Carol that affirmative actions aren't always designed and probably aren't typically designed to address certain kinds of disadvantage. And unless you are, in fact, looking at social class disadvantage and income disadvantage specifically, that's not going to factor in when you're looking at racial considerations. At the same time, if you're trying to promote racial diversity, that's an element of the educational diversity you're trying to promote, looking at class, looking at income isn't necessarily going to capture that. So if the goal is, in fact, trying to promote the diversity of your student body to include elements of racial diversity to try to integrate the student body, then I think really the best way to do that is to look specifically at race. And again,
spite of income, in spite of social background, whatever advantages that child may have had.
Well, they're not mutually exclusive. And I think certainly one can be disadvantaged and a member of a minority group, and one can be poor and white and poor and Black and be Black and not be poor. So certainly there are different combinations. But if we are trying to encourage a diversity that includes racial or includes consideration of race, and race is part of what we want in a student body in terms of its diversity, then the best way to look at it is, in fact, looking at admissions as well as other kinds of programs where race is part of the equation.
Carol Swain, the president of the University of Michigan, has warned that without affirmative action, if I read this correctly, the percentage of African-American students enrolled would almost certainly fall below 3%. And I guess currently, Angelo, it must be African-Americans, University of Michigan must be nearer 8%.
It's about 8-9%, right.
What do you make of that, Carol Swain? If we pull the plug on affirmative action, if the representation of African-Americans at the university falls to 3%, is it worth it?
I don't believe that it will fall to 3%. And I would like to say something that's wrong, I believe, with the point system. I believe that many institutions have have weighted in, they've looked at the indicators that minorities traditionally tend to score lower on, and so they have given those less weight. And so something like a perfect SAT mm-hmm. or a perfect essay, those things are undervalued, whereas race gets 20 points.
For all students or just for minority students?
For the minority students. And I think mm-hmm. it's problematic that we have told children, I mean, everyone knows you're expected to perform well, mm-hmm. what traditional indicators of merit are, and it looks as if someone decided that African Americans were genetically inferior, they would never be able to compete on the same basis as whites, so we'll change the criteria. And I don't believe these people that are saying that mm-hmm. these institutions will become lily white. I think it's totally racist. I don't buy it for a second. I think that minorities are capable of meeting whatever standards are put before them. And even before the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, you had minorities that were meeting the criteria and being admitted to predominantly white institutions. Mm-hmm. The problem was discrimination. They were being kept out when they were qualified. And I believe that blacks can meet whatever standard we put there. We have had an incentive structure that has worked against them, that's told them you can't do it.
A kind of disincentive structure.
Yes, a disincentive structure.
I almost hear you describing affirmative action itself as racist in a sense.
I think it's very racist, and I think the very whites that are liberal and that are, many of the ones that are very liberal mm-hmm. and they say they're the strongest supporters of affirmative action, they believe that minorities are incapable of competing with whites, and so they're no different from the white supremacists that say that blacks are genetically inferior, they're subhuman. They've decided that the world would be better if we had people in different colors in these institutions. And the diversity I see is almost like the similar person, people from similar backgrounds mm-hmm. in different shades, but not necessarily bringing diversity on other factors that are also important. And so I think the whole venture is misguided. It needs to be rethought. We are following the wrong path, and we are leading to racial divisiveness. And we need to change course.
Angelo Anchetta, how about it? Carol Swain says affirmative action itself has turned out to be, in its own way, racist, that it creates disincentives for high performance among minority students, that it's kind of insult because of the built-in expectation that she sees it as representing of performance.
Well, I think she's wrong. I mean, I disagree with most of what she just said. I don't think there's any question in looking at the representation of minorities that if affirmative action is removed, that we will see a drop in those enrollments. I mean, if you look at what happened in California at the enrollment at the University of California, Berkeley, at UCLA, the flagship campuses of the UC system, tremendous drops in enrollment.
This is after California had a referendum that said right. No more affirmative action.
Exactly.
And it's also after people went out and discouraged students from actually applying. And if you have a system that overinflates the percentage of minorities that are at an institution, of course, if you change that system, that people are already there, they're not going to have time to respond. So you have to give people time to adjust their behaviors to the changed environment, to the new incentive structure.
What about that, Angelo Anchetta? Might we have a lag that would, for a few years while people adjusted and expectations shifted, and then we'd be back to full representation?
Possibly, but that's not what's being played out in the University of California. If you talk to the one black student who was the only student at UCLA in his class, you talk to the two students who were the only students in their class at Bolt Hall, they will tell you that was not because they didn't want to go there or they didn't want to apply. They were very concerned about where they were going, and when they were there, they were very concerned about the fact that they were the only black students in their classes. And there's no question that when we are looking at the underrepresentation of minorities in these situations, that the worst thing that we can have is tokenism, and that the kind of racial isolation that they endure when they go to these institutions has to be addressed. And only through programs like affirmative action and positive admissions policies can we sort of address that problem directly.
So how long do we need affirmative action? I mean, if you argued that we need it forever, that would certainly sound racist. Is there some tenure that's reasonable for it? Have we reached that? Are we halfway there? Do you have any idea?
Well, part of what we're trying to do is, what are we trying to do with the policy? Are we trying to promote diversity? Now, if you are trying to promote diversity, and because of inequalities in the system, again, that pervade our educational system, that pervade our housing, that pervade our workforce, we're still dealing very much with discrimination, then obviously, if that is still an ongoing problem, I think there's going to be a continuing need for programs like these admissions policies that address that use race as one of many factors. Now, ideally, of course, we're going to get away from that, and we'll have a society where discrimination is very much an exception that rarely occurs, but we're not there yet, clearly.
Jack Beatty, here are starkly different views of the benefits, the downside, the causes and consequences of affirmative action. One, Carol Swain saying, you know, this builds in miserable expectations for races that are kind of racist in themselves. Angela Mancetta saying, with the inequalities and inequities in our society today, if you don't have some kind of positive action here, college admissions just further perpetuate a problem.
Yes, I would commend to our listeners a book by Derek Bach and William Bowen, former presidents of Harvard and Princeton, severally, called The Shape of the River. It was a study of 60,000 students at 28 selective, highly selective colleges who entered in the class of 1976. And they were trying to look at, they were trying to see how did the two common charges about hurts from affirmative action stack up to the facts. And the two common charges are that putting blacks in such an extremely competitive academic environment would hurt them, they would fail, and that even if they succeeded, it would stigmatize them such that they would suffer later in life. They say those arguments, based on their data, are, quote, demonstrably false. They say the more challenging the academic environment, the better African-American students did. The more they graduate, the more advanced degrees they hold, the higher salaries they earn later in life. And as for stigma, they found that the earnings differential between black and white students was smaller from these very selective schools where the stigma issue would be more acute than it was for schools generally. They found that something like above 90% of students, white and black, wanted either to support or to strengthen affirmative action, and that only 7% of black students regretted that they had been the beneficiaries of it. And they argue further that the earnings differential between women graduates has almost disappeared, slightly bigger for men. But on the other side, black men make a much stronger contribution to community. They're involved in more voluntary activities. They participate more and often in leadership roles. So Bach and Bowen said the social bounce from a black graduate from one of these elite schools that uses affirmative action is far greater than for a white.
Listeners, it's a complex picture out there today. No longer black and white. You're welcome to join us at 1-800-423-8255. Doug is on the line. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I've got a number of perspectives on this. I am a, and I'll start with what I think is the most important.
All right.
I'm a parent of African American children. I'm white. My wife is white. Our children are adopted.
Okay.
And until we had African American children, I think we were quite intellectual about this subject.
Mm-hmm.
Quote-unquote minorities in America become part of your family, you actually start to live it. And as a result of that, I've been involved in a group in our community for 10 years trying to deal with racism. I've also done diversity training in law firms.
But, Doug, does it make you more or less sympathetic to the goal, the fact of affirmative action?
I think the answer is as complex as the problem. Affirmative action, I agree with a lot of what Ms. Swain had to say.
Mm-hmm.
There is an aspect, an element to affirmative action that just sort of supports the dominant culture, institutional image that African Americans are inferior and other minorities are inferior. And I think it's that root cause that we need to be dealing with.
But for your children, black children raised in a white, white-headed household, should they have affirmative action advantages? They would seem to have, in not every respect, but in many respects, all the advantages of white children.
Well, but the problem is that, you see, they still get followed in stores, and they're still going to get stopped driving while black. And they still have faced all and internalized, regardless of what we can do about it, from television, from the culture, the notion that they are regarded differently, that there are different expectations of them, and that they are, the messages to them are, you are lesser.
Doug, stand by. I want to put that to Carol Swain. Carol, you hear the picture, and it's kind of an extraordinary one for just testing the premises of affirmative action itself. How do you respond to Doug? It sounds as though, in his unusual situation, he's still coming down on the side of affirmative action. He's still seeing the drag that can be on young black people in this society today, the headwind.
Again, there's something that we're missing, and that is that I think too often we sort of conflate discrimination with affirmative action, and I think discrimination calls for a different set of remedies. We have too many things all under that rubric of affirmative action, and I believe that it prevents us from finding and identifying effective remedies to combat discrimination. And so I would like to see race-neutral social welfare programs. And I would also like to see stronger measures to identify and combat discrimination. I think that middle-class minorities would benefit the most from these anti-discrimination measures. I think they can meet the same standards as whites. I think blacks at Harvard and Princeton and the elite schools, that they're closing the gap, and many of them are meeting the same standards. But we don't want to talk about those people. We don't want to talk about the ones that are meeting the standards because it doesn't fit the pretty little picture that's been put together by elites like Bowen and Bach, who have an incentive to preserve the status quo because it costs them nothing.
Doug, how about it? Carol Swain suggests that ultimately, yes, we need anti-discrimination measures and maybe new ones, but ultimately your children will be better off if they fight the battle without affirmative action. Are you ready for that?
Well, I don't just embrace one thing, and I think all your guests and all your callers are going to create a picture of reality that is multifaceted. I think there's a lot to what Ms. Swain says. There's no question. My kids are smart.
Sure.
My kids are smart, and it's really difficult as a parent to go through with them what they face when they get the messages that they're not smart.
But bottom line, do you still want some form of affirmative action or something else, something different?
It's alone, it doesn't do it, and it has to be a part of an effort by this country to really face up to what it believes. And that's the discussion we're not having in America because I think we're too politically correct about it. It can't come out.
What is the heart of that discussion, Doug?
The heart of the discussion is the belief in genetic superiority. That's my view.
White culture still just thinks it's better.
That's absolutely right. That's my experience. I think, I think Bowen and Bach's book is interesting, and I agree with Jack Beatty. It makes good reading. I would add, if people want to read something that kind of puts a frame on the 20th century, they might look at W.E.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk, which was written right at the beginning of the 20th.
We've got it, Doug. We've got to take a break. We thank you so much for your call. We're wading into deep water here. We're talking about affirmative action. It's back on the table. Does lowering the bar shortchange the beneficiaries of affirmative action? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Special events.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about affirmative action. It is back on the table, at least as regards college admissions. It's before the Supreme Court, and by this time next year, it could be history. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Are we somehow beyond all this? Should we be? Do we still need to pay attention to race to get beyond race? And are there better ways than affirmative action to do that? Or is this still the best, the only way to keep campuses integrated? And I guess a final question, should affirmative action be not race-based, but class-based? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest in the studio is Angelo Anchieta. He's legal director of the Civil Rights Project at Harvard. He's author of Race, Rights, and the Asian American Experience. And from Nashville, Tennessee, Carol Swain, professor of political science and law at Vanderbilt University. She's author of Black Faces, Black Interests, The Representation of African Americans in Congress. And in New Hampshire, Jack Beatty's with us as well. Joining us right now on the line is John. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to make a quick comment about some of the political dimensions of this and then ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
And my comment is this, that as a Democrat, I've grown increasingly concerned that affirmative action is now becoming a barrier to a true progressive politics. And what I mean by that is that affirmative action is actually creating wedges between groups that could otherwise be allied on this and other issues. So,
you still see whites and blacks or other groups divided over by jealousy or competition through affirmative action?
You see it on multiple levels. I mean, not only do you see electorally that there is now a huge, if you will, male gap in favor of Republicans, but you also see what I would call dueling affirmative action. So you have Hispanics and African Americans in Los Angeles fighting for power politically, which Hispanics are now gaining. And you also get kind of a really kind of almost absurd result in San Francisco, where the parents of Asian students sued the school district because San Francisco had laws that limited the representation in any public school to 40% of a given minority group, in effect discriminating against Asian students. They ended up winning.
Mm-hmm.
And my concern is that this issue, which I think at its core violates basically gut beliefs that many Americans have, that individuals should be judged and not groups, is preventing, first of all, it's not preventing more important progressive work like progressive taxation or potentially health care or spending on education, but it's actually preventing us from doing the really hard work here, which is to spend money on schools, which is to spend money on outreach. And I guess my question is do the panelists, do the groups see mm-hmm. the potential for what I would call a democratic post-affirmative action policy, say, one, phasing out over time, say, affirmative action in government contracting in 3 years, hiring in five, and maybe to your point about expectations, higher education, say, in 12 years, and maybe move towards spending the money on schools and maybe more class-based programs like Richard Kahlenberg describes in his book, The Remedy, and I'll take the answer off the air.
You got it, John. Thanks for your call. It sounds like you're ready for a sunset clause in affirmative action. Jack Beatty, how about that? John describes not just a wedge issue that might drive Democrats to the Republican Party, but wedges being driven between all kinds of groups here by affirmative action that we might be better off without, he suggests. Can you see an alternative politics emerging if affirmative action were diminished or done away with?
Well, I'm very partial to what he said. Historically, race was the bane of the populists. It broke the movement because the white racists could use it against the populists because they were trying to recruit blacks. And the progressive movement basically left African Americans out for that reason. I think we have to go ahead together. And I think the Democratic Party, black voters, there would be no Democratic Party today, insofar as it has anything, were it not for the support, the overwhelming support of African-American voters. So anything that would injure them, or that could be plausibly seen as something that would injure them, would have to be compensated for by some kind of massive effort in earlier education. And, you know, the numbers involved are more symbolic than anything else. I mean, Bowen and Bach find that if you had abolished affirmative action, the number of white students, the percentage of white students who would have been admitted to these 28 selective colleges would have risen from 25% to 26.5%. In other words, these places are so selective already that only a tiny percentage of white students would be admitted if there had been no affirmative action. So it isn't as if massive numbers of people are being discriminated against, it seems to me.
Carol Swain, weigh in on the politics here. Do you see Democrats as a real ally long term? You're pretty critical of the liberal perspective that has sustained support for affirmative action. Do you even see them as allies going forward for minorities, for African Americans?
I don't think that the Democrats or the Republicans are representing the interests of the American people. And I think the interests of the American people would be for us to have a set of public policies that would promote racial harmony and not racial divisiveness. And I believe that the Democrats very much take blacks for granted. I don't believe that we're going to move away from racial preferences until you get a crisis. And I do believe that the policies we have in place today in America will lead to unprecedented levels of racial conflict and turmoil because of conditions coming together at this point in history, such as the demographic changes, decreasing the percentages of whites in the population, the fact that regardless of whether or not affirmative action actually hurts white people, large numbers of them believe that it does. And so it creates resentment. I believe we need a new set of policies, and we can't depend on our political parties to take us where we need to go. I think we're headed towards a situation where we're going to have racial bloodshed at unprecedented levels, and that people will not believe it until they actually see the blood flowing in the streets.
Angela Mancetta, this is a critique that the drafters of affirmative action were surely not expecting to hear. How do you respond to this? Affirmative action is being presented here as a kind of wedge that's really poisonous over time. Yet I hear you describing the numbers of people who it has helped, the universities that it has made more diverse, the educations that it has thereby improved. But it's getting beaten up on here a bit tonight.
Right. Well, I think we may be confusing cause and effect here. There are bigger issues here at stake. And clearly, race is a tremendously divisive issue in America, and we're not always comfortable talking about it. In fact, we're quite uncomfortable at times talking about it. So I think – but to really point the finger at affirmative action as being the cause of that, I think is pointing the finger at the wrong kind
of problem. I'm not sure anyone's saying it's the cause, but it's almost coming across here as part and parcel of a picture that's not helping but rather hurting.
Well, I think we're trying to deal with some very long-standing problems that certainly have deep historical roots. And what we're trying to do here is through really quite modest measures when you think about it in terms of what these policies actually do, trying to remedy some very severe problems that have been going on for decades. Now, again, there are really deep-seated problems when we look at how, if we look from the political perspective, how parties and various political leaders are looking at race more generally. And Professor Swain has raised a very important point, which is that anti-discrimination shouldn't be confused with affirmative action. And I would agree entirely with her perspective that anti-discrimination efforts are woefully inadequate in America, and they're certainly not being addressed by either the Republican or the Democratic parties in any adequate way. But again, is affirmative action what we want to really focus on so much and try to address other kinds of racial problems that affirmative action is designed in, again, very modest ways, designed to address?
But the supporters of affirmative action are being portrayed by Carol Swain here as being a kind of condescending liberals, not ready to really dig in and address the deepest issues here, but rather kind of dressing things up by getting folks into college at the last minute before they go off into their careers.
Well, I don't know if you can necessarily point the finger at white liberals as being the only ones who are going to support affirmative action. If you look at the vote in my home state of California, in Prop 209, there were solid majorities among minorities for solid opposition to Prop 209. And unfortunately, a rather strong majority of white voters in support of Prop 209. So there was
which ended affirmative action.
Which ended affirmative action in the state. So there are still, I think, important differences among how people view race. And unfortunately, those differences fall along racial lines. So the perception of reality, the role of race in one's daily lives are vastly different. And that's reflected very often in things like voting patterns or in support for different policies.
Mm-hmm. Adam's on the line. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Good evening. How are you all?
Fine, thanks.
I was intrigued by an earlier caller's suggestion of what I believe you described as the sunset clause.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, has always been what's missing from discussions of affirmative action. I see affirmative action as an attempt to rectify imbalances caused by a racist society. It's not about promoting diversity. I mean, it's not about board scores. It's about we live in a racist society, and we're trying to level the playing field. And to me, supporters of affirmative action could give themselves a great deal more credence if they would outline a specific set of conditions which, if met, they could say, this is what we're trying to achieve. We no longer need affirmative action at the collegiate level. We'll retract it down to the high school level.
And what kind of conditions, Adam? Do you mean a certain level of acceptance, of matriculation of minorities without the assistance of affirmative action or something else?
Well, I think that would be a little simplistic, but what I simply mean is they could be anything, but we don't have them. We just have this very nebulous, oh, well, this is a good thing. It's like, okay, well, what are you trying to achieve, and how will you know if you've achieved it, in which case we can stop? Because obviously a color-indifferent society, as Ms. Swain is mm-hmm. idealistically for, and I commend her for it, is what we're I think what we're striving for, but how will we know? And so then we can say, okay, now we can stop focusing on college. Let's devote more of our energies to promoting equality both in class and race at the secondary school level or the elementary school level.
So Adam, put yourself on the Supreme Court. How do you vote? Thumbs up or thumbs down here? Or what?
I'm, at this point, I'm still in favor of affirmative action, but I would very much like to see some definite criteria, such as your other person was saying, 5 years down the road this, 10 years down the road that, because then we would have meaningful goals, and I think like that would, I think, remove some of the wedge that's been described.
Adam, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, how would this shift to a class-based affirmative action, work? And might it be just as effective as race-based affirmative action in keeping diversity on campus?
It might be, and the book by Rick Carlenberg, the earlier caller mentioned, The Remedy, is well worth reading for that account. But critics say that, that class is not a really adequate proxy for the disadvantages that go with race in America, and that inevitably you'd wind up, which would be laudable, giving more help to low-income whites than you would to blacks. I don't know about that. But you know what? I mean, if race is a controversial category in America, so is class. And people even defining what a class is in America, even saying what groups would be eligible, what incomes wouldn't, and so on. This gets into all kinds of, administrative and maybe even philosophical questions. I don't say it's impossible, and it's certainly worth thinking about, but there's a lot of complexity with it.
Angela Enchetta, in states where this has been prohibited, people have moved to other systems, saying anybody in the top 5, 10, 20% of their high school class is going to be admitted to the university, state universities in X state.
Right, and that's been adopted in Texas, California, Florida as well.
Does that work?
It's a little early to tell right at this point. The numbers are not where they were prior to the percent plans going into place, so it's not clear that they are working. There's certainly a lot of efforts being put forth, particularly in Texas, to look at recruitment, to look at support systems, look at scholarships, in addition to these kinds of percent plans. But maybe a little bit too early to tell whether they're really working or not.
Mm-hmm. And Carol Swain, put yourself on the Supreme Court. How do you vote? I guess you're voting thumbs down on affirmative action.
Well, again, I'm thumbs down on racial preferences, but not measures that promote equal opportunity and help for people that are disadvantaged, non-discrimination.
But those are really different issues, aren't they, from affirmative action? Doesn't that take you into a different arena?
I think what we are talking about tonight as affirmative action is really racial preferences, and that's what's controversial. That's what many Americans feel, you know, is unfair, and that's what that's part of the problem. And I think that because we're such a racially diverse society now, with whites decreasing as a percentage of the population, with so many groups eligible for preferences, I don't see how America in the 21st century can sustain racial preferences. I do think we owe people equal opportunity and fairness.
Carol Swain, it's been great having you tonight. You've given us a lot to think about. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Carol Swain joined us from Nashville. She's professor of political science and law at Vanderbilt University. And Angelo Enchetta here in the studio, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Angelo Enchetta is legal director at the Civil Rights Project at Harvard University. Jack Beatty, this is going to be some case to watch in the Supreme Court.
Yes, historic. W.E.B. Du Bois said the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, also of the 21st century.
Here it is, still with us. We will listen to that debate with great interest. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian Oriental.